Welcome back to another episode. We are your internet historians, and in today's episode, we will be discussing the history behind the movie Dallas Buyers Club. In mid-1980s Texas, electrician Ron Woodruff is stunned to learn that he has AIDS. Though told he has just 30 days left to live, Woodruff refuses to give in to despair. He seeks out alternative therapies and smuggles unapproved drugs into the U.S. from wherever he can find them. Woodruff joins forces with a fellow AIDS patient and begins selling the treatments to the growing number of people who can't wait for the medical establishment to save them. So, how'd you guys like it?
I love this movie.
It was good.
Did you
love
guys
it?
Like,
that's strong.
Okay, I don't love it actually. Now I don't love it.
I'm sad to love.
No, I don't love this movie. I like it a lot. I liked it more than I expected to. That's why I use it. Because I was expecting not to like it. But did you guys do the whole Jennifer Garner thing where you're like, she's pregnant? Because we talked about it last week.
Oh, no. I forgot
about that. Oh, really? I did it the entire time again this time.
Oh, oh dang. I forgot about that.
I was like, I wonder if this is like the end, like after she gave birth, or maybe they filmed it like in the beginning when, like, you know, because there were a couple scenes where she
must have been like early, because she did not look pregnant at all.
Yeah, she always had a lab coat on.
Yeah,
suspicious.
But even even when she was wearing like a shirt and pants, like,
yeah, there was one body. Scene. Yeah, there was one scene where she was wearing like a shirt and pants, and that's where I was like, is that after she gave birth or is that before in the beginning? You know, that was me. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I thought, you know, both Jared Leto and Matthew like looked so skinny. I was like,
yeah, Matthew McConaughey weighed 135 pounds for this movie, and he normally weighs like 188.
Damn.
I was like, dang, he's thinner than me.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm trying to get that summer body, and I'm looking at them like, oh my goodness.
But there's a scary skinny, not
there's
like a
really,
good
really,
oh, well, yeah.
No. Like, I don't even know how they can, that's what, like, to me, I'm like, how did you do that? Like, I'm freaking over here, like,
starve themselves.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, Jared Leto said that he got cast late into the movie, so he pretty much had to starve himself for like a month straight to get that thin, whereas Matthew McConaughey's was like all diet pretty much. So he had more time and was able to do it safely, but yeah. Apparently Jared's was just like,
I was just thinking about too, about how like skinny they were and stuff, and I was like, dude, I don't think I'd be able to do that, and like how you just have to be so committed to that role in order to make yourself that freaking skinny. And like, because I know how I get when I'm hangry, so it's like, how, like, I want to know how their mood swings were and stuff like that when they were like dieting or like starving themselves basically for this role, because I would be mean. I know that
I
much
feel
for
like,
sure.
I feel like there's a difference, because like when we starve ourselves, like we're just doing it for vanity, but when they're doing it because they're gonna get paid. So
that's what I was about to say. I was like, you got to think about the millions of dollars that you're getting for this role, and that's got to get you through.
Yeah.
Yeah, just had to see the light, the dollar sign at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm.
And the awards.
No, yeah. That'd be so hard. Like, ugh. I think it's like kind of reminding me of like how, you know, you have to wake up to go to work or whatever. And like,
yeah,
people are like, is it worth it or whatever? Like, I feel like that's what I would be thinking, like, while I'm serving myself. Like, is it really worth it for me to be feeling this way right now? Like, is it? And then you're like, okay, yeah, I got to. And then you just get out of bed or don't eat the whatever you're trying to eat.
Yeah, exactly. But other than that, I think I really like this movie. I like the story, even though it's a real story. I felt like I didn't really know about any of this stuff until I watched the movie.
Mm. Yeah, I liked it. I don't know. It was just like, I don't know if I would watch it again, though, like that kind of thing. Like, it was cool to watch the one time. I just don't know if I'd like enjoy watching it again or anything. But I mean,
that's what I did. I like watched it once, and then this is like my second time watching it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, this is also. Yeah, this is also my second time watching it, because like I always do when movies are nominated for a million awards, I try to watch it before the award show. So I hadn't seen it since it came out in 2012 or 2013.
Yeah, one of those years, 12 or 13.
Yeah, one of those years. And it's kind of crazy because I remember at the time, I mean, just with a movie almost 10 years old, it's just crazy how different the climate is, because even though this was in like the 2010s, how much it wouldn't fly that Jared Leto was playing a trans character these days, I just don't think it would fly. And it's crazy because they were like praising him at the time, which I don't even really get into that, but they were like praising him. And it's just like now thinking about it, I'm just like, man, they get so pissed.
Dude, I was just reading this article about actors who have come out saying, like, criticizing their past roles of what they felt they shouldn't have portrayed. And Jared Leto was in there saying that he doesn't think he should have played the character too because of basically stuff that's going on. It was like a whole list of people and just like what role they played and then why they thought they shouldn't have played it, kind of a thing. And yeah, he was on there.
Dang.
Well, at least he recognizes, I guess. And is actually thinking back on it.
Yeah.
Didn't the Danish girl come out after, it came out after this movie, right? And then I know
that, but there was like a whole time frame where a whole bunch of people were playing like transgender people and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I was actually thinking that during the movie. I was like, I wonder if Jared got some, you know, hate for playing his role. I couldn't remember, though.
I mean, I barely even knew anything about this film when it came out, so I definitely didn't hear anything about backlash about it, so I don't know.
I just remember he went to the Oscars looking like Jesus. He had, an ombre. Oh,
was that
something.
When he went?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. See, I remember that. I just don't remember the role he went there for.
Yeah, that's all I remember. And then I feel like he got a lot of praise for this. And then he did Suicide Club, right? Or is it Suicide Squad. And I'm like, club. And
I don't know if I want to be a part of that.
I know, my bad. So he did that. And I feel like there was so much on him for that role because he did such a good job in this role, right? Is that how the
flow
went?
That's an entirely different situation because he's playing a fictionalized character. Well, they're both fictionalized, obviously. Yeah. One is an entirely made up character for this movie.
Hey, we don't know that yet.
Oh, sorry. And then one is a very well documented, well loved character. And that's where he got the hate, was that people didn't, especially after Heath Ledger's portrayal of Joker. People did not like his portrayal of the Joker. So that was I don't really think that had anything to do with his acting or it really, I think people just are silly.
Okay. Well, don't you feel like they do that once they win an award and then the next movie that they do, it's there's so much pressure on that movie. It's it has to be so good. Yeah. They just won this award. I feel
like they're also different styles of movie too. So I'm like, I don't know. One's more silly than the other one to me, at least. So I'm
Well, I just think of exactly what I was talking about earlier with Angelina Jolie and Changeling and then the movie Salt, because that's what happened. I was I felt there was a lot of publicity on the movie Salt, or I remember it very specifically, and it's because of how well she did in Changeling.
Okay, so let's learn something about a good old Ron Woodruff here.
It was kind of like I said, it was kind of difficult to find much on him because there really isn't much. I mean, I believe it was a Slate article. They said that the most comprehensive knowledge of him or his works pretty much belong to the screenwriters. They recorded over 20 hours of interviews with him and had access to his personal journals. So I guessed now I'm getting them mixed up, but I want to say it's the screenwriter. I guess the screenwriter had heard about Ron through a friend, and this was towards the end of his life, and he interviewed him because he ultimately wanted to make a movie about him. So they did get to speak with him before he passed away. So yeah, they pretty much know him well, besides which they don't talk about at all in the movie, and I guess they didn't even consult Ron's family at all, but Ron did have a sister and a daughter. So I will talk about what we do know.
Do they have any of the recordings? Could you listen to those recordings?
I don't know.
I was just I'm curious what he sounds like.
Yeah, me too. I don't know. But it's kind of hard because the screenwriter says that, you know, the script in the movie is a pretty accurate portrayal. But then there have been friends that have come out since that are just I disagree.
I think I saw something online too that said that the movie was 60% accurate or something like that, or based on real things or whatever.
Yeah, so bit of a toss up on how accurate this movie is, unlike some others that we've had in the past where it's pretty dead on. This one is kind of creative. So from the little bit that's on his Wikipedia, Ronald Dixon Woodruff was an American man who created what would become known as the Dallas Buyers Club in March 1988, one of several such AIDS buyers clubs that sprang up at the time. After contracting the human immunodeficiency virus, I don't think I've ever said that whole word before, the actual acronym, in 1985, he created the group as part of his efforts to find and distribute drugs to treat HIV at a time when the disease was poorly understood. He was born in Dallas, Texas on February 3rd, 1950. So what they completely leave out of the movie is his personal relationships and the fact that he was married three times. They pretty much just jump into it where he's living the bachelor life and living the promiscuous life. It's very yikes. I mean, the very opening scene, you're just like, this is intense. Anyway, his first marriage was to Mary Etta Pybus in 1969, and they had a daughter, Yvette Lynn Woodruff, and she's still alive. And I had read some interviews with her and her, I guess technically her aunt, and they, for the most part, they seemed like it was a decent portrayal of him. I guess Ryan Gosling and Brad Pitt were in talks of playing him before Matthew McConaughey was, and both of them were just like, no way, there's no way that they could like pull off his like attitude. So they were actually pretty happy with Matthew McConaughey's casting, especially because Matthew's from Texas, so they were just like, a real Texan playing a real Texan. So they're happy about that. They divorced in 1972. And then later that year, he married another woman. And then they divorced a year later in 1973. And then in 1982, he married his third wife, but they divorced in 1986 after he was diagnosed with HIV. They describe him, he had a mercurial personality. One reporter writes that Woodruff took guns to his doctor's office, prompting Dr. Stephen Pounders to fire him as a patient. Woodruff later sent the doctor roses and the doctor took him back. So I guess he had highs and lows to his personality. So what I had from the little extra bit that I had from Slate was in the film, Ron is portrayed as a part-time rodeo cowboy and an electrician prior to his diagnosis. He has a threesome with two women in a rodeo stall and is seen cracking misogynistic and homophobic jokes with his buddies while on break from work. The real Ron was indeed an electrician who worked as an independent contractor with sporadic employment, but though the film begins and ends with him in a rodeo setting, Woodruff was only a rodeo enthusiast, not a rider. These details, as a screenwriter explained, were used as a metaphor for his character's struggle and ability to survive far longer than his doctor said he would, a lassoing of the bull. As for his friends, Woodruff did indeed lose them after his diagnosis was made known, as shown in the film. So it seems like, as I said, they like took real stuff as like a seed and kind of like flowered the authenticity of the actual fact. But I mean, as a metaphor, I guess that makes sense, but it did kind of leave me wondering if he actually ever was a bull rider. As for his diagnosis, in the movie, Ron is diagnosed in 1985. The screenwriter says this is the best estimate as to the year Woodruff found out about his status, but Woodruff told the screenwriter that a doctor had informed him he might have the disease well before that. Woodruff even suggested that he could pinpoint when he may have contracted the disease. He described a sexual encounter with a woman in 1981 that didn't quite feel right. Woodruff suspected she may have been an intravenous drug user and referred to some really raw stuff that didn't go into the movie. The film alludes to that encounter with a brief flashback showing Ron and an unidentifiable woman. We see this just after Ron, going through microfilm in the library, learns that AIDS can be caused by having unprotected sex. Mm-hmm. Which JC and I watched this, which he hasn't sat down to watch one of our movies in a while, so I'm just like, come watch this movie with me. It's got Matthew McConaughey, it'll be a rousing time. Not really, but and like it made me question like my knowledge of sexually transmitted diseases, because I mean, obviously I was born in the 90s and the AIDS epidemic was very much an 80s thing. And so it just was so crazy to me how his friends flipped on him so instantly about him being gay. And I was just like, but they know that you can get it from drugs, right? Right? And JC's just like, no, not really. It was mostly in the gay community, and mostly the doctors knew that you could get it through needles, not because it's because he was a drug user in the movie and they all were using drugs. So I was just like, they all use drugs. Why don't they know? And it's just like, that just wasn't the agenda that was pushed with the AIDS epidemic, which I thought was crazy.
Well, and for remember when we were doing, oh my God, who was it?
Freddie.
The others, yeah. Who was it? Not Freddie. Elton John. Remember when we were talking about Elton John, and then because I forget what the kid that he became friends with had AIDS or whatever.
Yeah.
And one of the big things was that that kid was like kicked out of, or was the parents were trying to kick him out of the school because they didn't know how it's transmitted. No one knew how it was transmitted. That's why I think they just assumed that, oh, that they were gay or whatever, and that's how it was transmitted. And
they assumed like shake he would cough. Anything. Like if he coughed on
them, they wouldn't like even touch him or anything. And I actually also recently was watching something on Princess Diana, and I guess she was like one of the first people to be publicly like photographed shaking hands with someone who had HIV or AIDS or whatever. And that was a huge deal because then it showed like, oh, she didn't contract it that way. So that's why it was like a big thing for people to see that. So I think, back at that time, I think it was also because it was so new too, right? So people were just kind of like, what is this?
Yeah. It's just crazy because like when he was reading the microfilm or whatever in the library, because it said like 17% or whatever would contract it through drug use. And I'm like, that's a big percent. Like, obviously it's not like, what was it? Like the 80% or whatever that was through sex, but it was just like, what the heck? Like, that's a pretty, it's just, I don't know. It's just crazy to me, but it just really obviously stems from the homophobia. And it's just unfortunate that that's what people thought. But I guess we'll get into the homophobia. All right. So I got all of this info from a Huffington Post article, and it was kind of up in the air about what was going on with him. The screenwriter, again, like as he interviewed him and said that he pretty much stuck by the fact that he was as racist and homophobic as they portrayed in the movie, and the screenwriter sticks by that. But there have been people that have come out since that were like, that's not the Ron I knew, which doesn't it always happen that way? So William Wayborn, the former president of the Dallas Gay Alliance, knew Woodruff well from volunteering together and running in the same circles in Dallas. He told Huffington Post that the movie's depiction of Woodruff as a heterosexual who struggled to be around gay men is at odds with everything that Wayborn knew about Woodruff. He says, quote, I never saw the straight side of Ron. That's what was the most surprising part of this whole movie. He worked in a gay center. He was surrounded by gay men, and as far as I knew, had relationships with gay men. I can't tell you exactly what his sexual orientation was or anyone's, but he certainly had no problems being around us. Stephen Pounders, Woodruff's primary doctor during his fight with HIV, has said that he has never saw the homophobia in Woodruff that is present in the film. He says, quote, the screenwriters were really concerned how the community would react if they portrayed him as a straight guy. He seemed to me very comfortable in the gay environment, like any other gay man. A piece from Slate on Woodruff's sexuality points out that the film's co-writer, Craig Borton, has long defended his belief that, like I said, was as racist and homophobic as they come. The piece also quotes another medical professional who treated Woodruff, nurse Penny Crispin, as telling the Sunday Times that, quote, Ron was one of my gay patients. I never knew anyone who thought Ron was straight. David France, the director and producer of the critically acclaimed AIDS documentary, How to Survive a Plague, also joined HuffPost for the discussion and argued that Dallas Buyers Club made Woodruff heterosexual to stop the movie from being perceived as a gay film. He says, quote, it turns on some of those old tropes that you really need to see the transition of a straight man's journey in order to be able to understand gay people. We don't need that anymore. We don't need to ride the coattails of bigotry to get into mass culture. So
that was one thing I saw too about like the criticisms of this film was that they used a straight dude to kind of portray like the problems that people had with like getting the medicine that they need and stuff when they had AIDS. And they're like this, like, yeah, obviously it can happen to straight people, but it was a more of like a gay thing that happened, or something that happened in the gay community more like frequently
Yeah, I saw that too, that there were a lot of people that were a lot of gay people that were a part of these buyers clubs, and I guess even more prominent than Ron was, and they're just like, well, why are you making this movie about this straight guy when it's, it was a bigger deal in the gay community? But I don't know.
Yeah, I also saw something about like how they the this doctor who worked closely with the Buyers Club in Atlanta didn't like how it showed kind of how profit hungry Ron is. Like he did a lot of this more so for profit than for like trying to help a community. And he said in the Atlanta Buyers Club, like it was very much so a community trying to help each other out. And it's so, but I don't know if that was
I'm
Ron's
just wondering
intentions.
if that's, yeah, because I'm just wondering if that's just their portrayal of him in this movie. Because something that I read was that he cashed in his life insurance policy to support this program. Like he took, like, it was like a six-figure life insurance policy, but he took like $60,000 in cash just to keep the program afloat. So I don't know. I feel like if he was this involved, he did care, but.
Yeah. I feel like when I was reading the Wikipedia page on the movie too, that they like had a like a part in there where they're like, oh, he goes from like only for profits and like now he just wants to make sure these people are getting like the medicine they need, basically is what the like summary of it was. But I'm like, but I when I was like watching the film, I was like, I didn't really see that much of that aspect in the movie, even though this was like a Wikipedia page, you know, like they literally list each thing that's in the movie or whatever. But yeah, because I mean, I guess there was like one scene where the two gay men, I think, were sitting there at the table, and she was like, oh, I guess something about the AZT drug, and that they don't know if they'll have enough money to pay for this. And he's like, okay, cover, make sure they're covered or whatever. And I feel like that was the only scene where they kind of showed that he was okay with like not making money off of it, because I think that was when Rayon died or
Yeah, I was
whatever.
gonna say all of
Spoilers,
it
I don't know. I'm like,
happens.
spoiler alert.
Yeah, all of it happened. His like character arc, like his huge turnaround, is after Rayon died. So it seemed more like Rayon motivated than actual like motivation for, a community.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's kind of like one of those things which sucks, but it's, I don't want to say it's like a right-wing thing, but it's just kind of, it's one of those things where it's like you can't sympathize with something until it happens to you, and that's when it really changes your way of thinking. And it kind of was very much that, where it's just like he really, it was very much for profit. I'm making this as my business partner, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like as you get to know Rayon and he gets closer to Rayon, he realizes it's like bigger than, whatever. And then obviously, once he's close, Rayon passes, then, then it actually matters to him because he actually lost someone that he cared about.
I can see that it was a community, but I think like the person that I watched in the YouTube interview just didn't like how there was that like profit type of motivation. 'Cause I guess he just, it wasn't towards Dallas, it was just like buyers clubs in general. He just like didn't want buyers clubs just to have like a wrong light on them.
I can see that, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Especially, yeah, after I looked into what buyers clubs are, which I guess
Tell us.
I know, I'm like, man, these segues are just like
So
transitions are
smooth.
very good today. Yeah. Actually, when I was looking into the buyers club, like what they actually are, I guess there's like different ones. Like there's a couple different, I guess, what is it, definitions of one, but I looked up obviously the one specific to the AIDS epidemic. So here is the definition, I guess you could say, of what a buyers club is. So, buyers clubs are groups of people who come together to try and purchase goods that are typically too difficult to obtain by themselves. So, in the case of the AIDS epidemic, buyers clubs became important as a means of obtaining medications not yet approved by the FDA that members thought might be useful in treating HIV and opportunistic infections. The first and largest of these was the People with AIDS Health Group, founded in 1986. AIDS buyers clubs distributed such unapproved drugs as ribavirin, dextrin, sulfate, and DCNB, which is another long name that I don't know how to say, as well as cheaper pirated versions of ziduvudine, which is basically AZT, which was the first drug that was FDA approved for the treatment of AIDS. AIDS buyers clubs also distributed information about the disease and drug developments and became an important source of AIDS treatment education advocacy.
And I think buyer's clubs are still kind of around today. I don't know. I don't think they're as, I think, big of a thing as they were like back then and like this type of aspect of like the film and stuff. But I saw that they are kind of still around and stuff for people. So I can see what you're saying, Lisa, about like the wrong light. Cause I think they were kind of a good outlet for people, especially if people who don't have like the financial means to get the access to the drugs and medication that they need to help their disease or even learn about their disease.
It makes me think of like Planned Parenthood, right? Like,
yeah, I guess kind of, yeah. And also too, because like one of the things was like basically for a buyer's club, it'd be like if a group of people want to get something at like a cheaper rate, like they would all come together to buy it in like a bulk quantity basically. So I guess it's kind of like the same thing in that aspect. They all came together so that way they can have access to like a more abundance of a certain type of drug. So that way it's like a little bit cheaper as well. Now I want to talk about two people in the film who had an impact on Ron and seemed to kind of help him turn into a more likable person who understands others were the characters of Dr. Eve Sachs and Rayon. So as we already mentioned, Rayon is not a real character and neither is Dr. Eve Sachs, but they were kind of like loosely based off of people in the fact that they like interviewed a lot of doctors and they interviewed a lot of transgender people who were kind of around at the time of this. So they kind of just put all those people together and these characters to kind of represent, I guess, that whole group of people. But I guess Eve was kind of more based on someone. So as Alec already said, there was a doctor who was kind of Ron's main person that he went to for his medical stuff. And his name was Steve Pounders. He was Ron's doctor and he had heard of what Ron was doing, but he said the patients that he gave the drugs to didn't know how to take them. So he tried to help with patients by starting like their IVs and helping them get the drugs and administer them and use like the proper protocols and stuff like that. So that way they knew, like he would basically educate them on how to inject the drugs that they were illegally getting into the United States. So I think, I mean, that's kind of important. I think he just wanted them to prevent any further type of something going wrong with them. So this is what he also said. He said, we didn't know if these drugs would help and we didn't know if they would hurt, but at least we knew a few things about them. I tried to keep people out of trouble. He was my patient for several years until he passed away. Oh, and there was one thing that I saw too that he said, because I guess there was a question like, oh, are you like upset that they like changed it to a woman? Because, you know, I guess that's what she was kind of based on. And he was saying that, no, he doesn't really care about that, but he likes that her name was Eve because Eve is like really close to Steve or whatever. And so he's like, oh, I was represented in that way. which I was like, yeah, I guess you can, it's a way to look at it. Also, Ron had judges, nationally recognized doctors and lawyers who all helped him keep his club afloat. Again, I was trying to look up specific people because I was like, I want to know exactly like how he was able to get all these drugs in and shit like that. But there was like no specific names ever. It was always just like he had these types of people helping him and then these types, but it was never like anyone specific other than the Steve Pounders dude that I could find. And then also some of the doctors who were treating patients for like with the AZT, if they were kind of noticing that their patients were kind of not really like taking well to the drug, they would kind of basically like be like, oh hey, here's this number of this guy, he might be able to help you kind of thing. So they would kind of turn those people to him to kind of get them the help that they needed. And then I also looked into, like I said, about how he was getting the drugs. And because, you know, in the film, they kept showing him like in Japan or all these places and getting these drugs Mexico and stuff. So I was like wanting to see like, I don't know if there are really doctors like that, but I could only find again that he was getting some, smuggling them in from Mexico. And he said that, oh, and he did go with disguises like the priest and the, I think it was a lawyer, no, a doctor. So yeah, he smuggled them from Mexico and he smuggled about 300 times. He made like trips across the border.
Dang.
And he like, I guess, souped out his car to basically be like a shell of a car, basically, or not the whole car, but there was like certain parts of his car where it basically was just like a shell and he like put all the drugs in there. And there was one story where he was talking about how he was kind of, I guess, nervous because when the border patrol dude was asking him questions, he was like, yeah, yeah, totally. And then as he kind of just started driving away, I guess there was something within the car where all the drugs were at that was like making noise or like kind of sagging his car. And he was like, oh my God, I'm about to get like pulled over or something. He said he like made it out and he just basically like sped off away to like hurry me get out of there. But yeah, so this is what he also said about those trips that he made across the border. Ron said that he was careful, but it never gets easier. You sweat a lot and your hands feel like fish. You live in a low-rent motel while waiting for your connection. You worry about federals, informers, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and people who will kill you for your drugs or money. He was, putting in the risk, going, doing all this stuff. But that's one thing, too. He was, like, saying that he'd never been shot at or anything like that, doing these trips. But that, yeah, and I think that is, like, I don't know, like, especially doing it that many times, you would think after a while, like, oh, this is, like, nothing to him now, but apparently it wasn't. He knew kind of how much in trouble he could get if he were to get caught.
I don't know if he was actually like this in real life, but at least in the movie, he seemed very well informed about like what he could and could not do. Because I mean, there's like the times when he's meeting with the DEA guy where he's just like, it's not illegal, you know, it's just not approved.
Yeah.
So what are you trying to do?
I think it was kind of similar to that though too, because I think a lot of the times, or at least what I read, that like certain things would kind of just look the other way a lot of the times when he was doing it, because they were just kind of like you said, it's like nothing really that he was doing illegal. It's just like, I think the distribution of it part was like not
selling
really,
it.
Yeah. Like yeah. Not the legal part. So yeah, I think that's how he was kind of able to get away with it. Cause yeah, I feel like in the film, there was just many times I'm like, I don't get like how they like they're catching him, but like not really, like they're just like finding him or, you know, like taking all everything away and whatnot.
I think I thought I read somewhere that I don't know if he like became friends with someone in the FDA or like maybe they just started to get to know him. And like when they would catch him, they got to like a point where they allowed him to use the whatever it is, like they would only allow it for him, like he couldn't distribute it. So
well, they said that at the end of the film too.
Oh, they did.
Well, it was, I mean, just like
said that the first time he crossed the border.
And
no, oh yeah, I remember
too, at the end too, right?
But I just thought it was for me at least, like I guess what I thought it was interesting is I feel like they did make the FDA seem like a really really bad, you know, corporate, you know, like a whole bad,
like, out to get the little person kind of a thing. Like I was like, everything really is corrupt.
I mean,
yeah, that was in an article that I was reading. I can't remember if it was like Variety or something, but yeah, that was like their main problem with this movie, is that they made it seem like this like libertarian guy who had it out for the government, and you know, they were pushing their agenda of big pharma and blah blah blah.
But he didn't trust the government though, or like anything like that. He kind of was, or Ron was, very like anti-establishment or whatever I would say. But yeah, in the movie, they really did make it seem like the FDA. I was like, wow, I didn't realize the FDA was so bad.
Yeah.
They really out to get Ron.
Yeah. That was what surprised me, that like some of it, you know, wasn't so bad. I was like, okay, I guess like.
Yeah. And I think
it's a little better.
Something too from the FDA saying that they didn't like obviously how they were portrayed, because that's not their goal. Their goal is to help people and get more access, I guess, to stuff, or I don't know.
Yeah. I was kind of perplexed by the same agent saying that if he like goes through the right application process or something, like he could get it approved. And I'm like, well, why doesn't he just do that? Like it's so easy. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
But he had multiple freaking like court cases and stuff like that too, I think, against people and stuff. So
oh yeah, that's one of the things I forgot to mention it earlier, but another reason why they were saying that he couldn't be so homophobic was because I guess there were a couple times where he did go to court and was like fighting for these alliances and these groups and stuff, these LGBTQ groups, and they're like, well, why would he go to court and like put his neck out, you know, for people that he hated so much? So there's like, he couldn't be that homophobic. Anyway,
but I mean, it's not like it's that hard to believe either, from like their location and stuff like that, in the time period that it was. But I mean, maybe he has heart, or he did have a change of heart or something too. So I mean, and now that we're talking about the FDA, let's learn about what they actually did approve.
Good old AZT. Alrighty. Okay. So most of the information I got was from the Washington Post. Okay. So first of all, I want to start off by saying I'm not a doctor. I have nothing to do with the medical field. I did get first aid certified once, so I do know how to put on a Band-Aid, and that's about it. So take everything I am saying with a gallon of salt. And second, I'm also really dumb. So
What I'm going to explain to you guys is like my dumbed down version of this, but I hope it's entertaining. All right. So is AZT really that bad? And like all things, they're bad if you overdo it. So in the film, they plant AZT as the enemy, the antagonist, the Eye of Sauron. You know what I mean? So... But like, I was like thinking of AZT as like radiation, like remember guys, radioactivity. So, you know, like when they first, you know, discovered the radiation, they were like, oh my God, this cures cancer. And then they learn like, oh God, no, it's like really bad. So it's kind of the same.
They caused it sometimes.
Yeah, it's like, it's too much. It's not a good thing. Like we're not even allowed. Oh, if you didn't listen to that episode, you should. That is like one of the best because we're all together. We were really feeling each other, had a great time. Go check it out. But anyway, so AZT is like an antiviral. So it's what it is. It's supposed to kill a virus. And they thought it would help with HIV because that's a virus. But the thing about HIV is that it mutates. So it has a very high mutation rate, which is why it's so deadly. Unlike the flu virus, right, where you could just get a shot, boom boom bam, we're done. HIV, it's like, no way, Jose, I'm coming back. All right, so when they began the research, you know, they would give a patient a high dosage, which is why they had a really bad reaction, and which is why like Ron was like so against it, because like I said, with all things, if you do too much, it ain't good. But then once they learn that this isn't fixing the problem, they lowered the dosage and they did notice that it did kind of help with HIV. And then I was like, so I wrote here, I was like, side note, I didn't look into this, but I wanted to point out that in the movie, they seemed like very motivated on like destroying HIV. Again, they like made it seem like it's the enemy. Like we must destroy it. We must get rid of it. It will never be upon us again. And I think that's like very strange. I don't know if that's the mindset of the time, but I guess for me, like, and I mean, we're living in a pandemic right now, and I don't even have that mindset of like, it's going to be gone forever. Like, no, like, I think that, you know, we're going to have to continue to deal with this for centuries. I mean, we're still dealing with the chicken pox. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of had to do with how little they knew about the disease at the time, because it's just like, if you think about like polio, technically polio isn't really a thing anymore because, you know, of the vaccines and everything else that's come out. But like, think of cancer. Cancer's still a thing, but they realize that, you know, you can't, I mean, depends on the case, you know, can't completely eradicate cancer. Cancer is always going to be a thing, but you can learn to live with it or mitigate it. And I think it's just kind of when something like this emerges and a new disease comes out, your first go-to is to just to get rid of it. Like if we can get rid of it, that's what we're going for, instead of, you know, doing the research and finding a way for people to live with it until you can, you know, actually put in the time and the work and actually get rid of it. So I feel like that's probably why they just, that was like the go-to get rid of it, not like how can we just keep these people alive type of a thing.
Yeah,
that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I understand that mindset. I guess it just like struck me a weird way, and then that's why I brought it up. All right, back to AZT. So as I said, HIV mutates and they realize, you know, you can't just treat it with one antiviral. So they later realize that they need to make a concoction, which they call the triple whammy. So they mix three antivirals together, AZT being one of them. And that seemed to help because HIV could defend itself against one antiviral, but it couldn't defend itself against three. So now AZT is in a pill form called Combivir. And again, I think, or those two antivirals are also in there. And in 2005, it was the number one selling antiviral. So overall, AZT isn't the worst. And then it's like, what about Pepto-AT?
The dosage was bad.
Yes. It just was not executed properly.
Yeah. I was going to say to you in the scene where Jennifer Garner is like, put them on the lowest dosage or whatever of AZT. And I was like, I wonder if that was like, they're like, not, what is it? Like they're not at being like, oh, AZT, like if it's low, it's okay. Kind of a thing. Yeah. But
it just sucks. Like in order to do this medical research, you know, you're going to make those types of mistakes. And unfortunately, like someone's life is on the line for this. I hate that. Ugh, I'm getting the creepies over it, but it just sucks that it has to go that way. Now, peptide T. So it's really interesting because from my research, doctors and articles are like, yeah, there's no evidence that peptide T works. They did try to do a study on it and it more or less failed. Ron swore by it, but they just couldn't find the medical, like the evidence they needed to say, yes, this does improve somebody's health. So I don't know. Like, you know, that placebo effect. I don't know if it was that. I don't know. This other thing though. So when, you know, you join like the buyers club Ron would push and push that everyone needed to like improve their lifestyle. They have to get like eat a healthier diet, stop doing drugs, drink less, etc. And so I don't know. I think that kind of contributed with Ron and his health. And then it was like funny because doctors are like, we've been saying that for years. I'm like, you know what? That's true. Doctors do tell us eat a better, eat a balanced diet, work out more. And I'm like, you know, if a doctor told me I need to change my diet and work out more, I'd be like, okay, whatever. I'm going to go back to bed. But if a YouTuber told me the same thing, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to go do that right now. Like even right now, I'm just saying, even right now I'm going on YouTube. Like, what should I be eating? What workout should I be doing? But like whenever I go to the doctors and they're like, you know, you should take a walk around. And I'd be like, sure. So that's an interesting thing.
But like most doctors aren't like, that's not their, what is it? Their specific thing that they study though, too. Like you would have to go to like a dietitian, right? Or something like that. Yeah. Or someone like that. Cause like, that's like their specialty. So I mean, I don't know.
No, I know. They don't tell you like exactly what you should be eating. They just tell you, you know, like change your diet and work out more. And it's just, to me, it was just funny. Cause it's like the doctors were kind of like, we've been saying that. And like Ron just tells them and everyone's like, oh my God, miracles.
Well, I mean, they like wanted something to like help cure them. So, I mean, if they're like, someone's like, this is going to cure you of your illness, then you're going to be like, okay, yeah, let me hurry up and do that right now. So,
yeah.
Well, probably also just really hard to change a lifestyle because it's the 80s. Like that was very much a lifestyle. I mean, he's snorting cocaine left and right.
See all the alcohol and everything he was doing. Not caring about his body whatsoever.
Yeah. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, I think of like my parents and they don't like look at the package when they like buy food or something. I'm always like, is it organic? Is it like, and I'm looking at the meat. I'm like, is it grass fed, pasture raised? Oh, like mom, like, so that's something too. I think like they were even showing in the movie how he was like reading the label and he was like, what is that? So yeah. Anyways, lastly, I wanted to kind of bring up that Ron did smuggle a DDC, which is also an antiviral, but it had harsher side effects than AZT. So I was like, this is also sus. Like, what the heck? It's like, it's weird because yeah, he smuggled the DDC and I bet he was giving maybe he was also letting some people use it in a lower dosage. You know, again, it's an antiviral as well, so it probably did have some effect. Yeah, at the end of the day, they figured it out, right, guys? Like people nowadays, you know, are able to live a more or a longer life with the virus, and so it's not a death sentence like it was back in the day.
Yeah. No, yeah, when I was watching this film too, I was like, whoa, I didn't realize AZT was like not good for you. I was like, why are they giving everyone it? Or, you know, I'm like, oh my God. And then I'm like, okay, that's not entirely true. That's why. But
I did hear recently that there is a pretty promising vaccine for HIV that's in development right now.
Wow.
I mean, it's still in the early studies, but it's looking pretty good. So
that's good.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that one.
That's so crazy.
I heard something recently about a vaccine that's doing pretty well in its trials and stuff. So,
Very, very cool.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I always like think about, or I was like thinking about this with the terms of like lifestyle, because obviously when I was younger, I was like, whatever, I'm gonna eat whatever I want, drink whatever I want, holla, like I'm living life. But then now I'm getting older, I'm constantly like looking at like how I can improve my health and lifestyle. And even like when this whole pandemic started, Luis likes to listen to Joe Rogan, and he also kind of will discuss like, you know, like we need to be learning how to build up our immunity, like we need to be taking vitamins and doing this and working out more and sweating at the top, like, you know. And I'm always so interesting to me, and I don't know, I feel like Ron, where I'm like, I'm gonna look for an alternative way to live healthier. But then when I get a headache, I'm like, Advil please.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and give us a rating. And we would also love to connect with you, so make sure you follow us on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we'll be discussing Chris McCandless from the movie Into the Wild. So don't forget to tune in. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.
Bye.